Well, another chapter, but this is the final chapter in this overall process we've been talking about for a long time now, which is the complete oxidation of glucose. Well, really, we're already done oxidizing glucose, right? Where did that stop? Right, in the citric acid cycle. No more glucose, no more fuel is left at that point. But the process really isn't complete yet because we haven't finished dealing with the energy that we've extracted from that original glucose molecule in the form of the electrons that have been stripped from it. So this final part, the final part of the overall process, and also the final part of cellular respiration, which is just part of that overall process, is what? It's what? What is the final part of cellular respiration? Oxidative phosphorylation, and we talked about part of that last time, right? Electron transport. So today's topic is what? Chemiosmosis, exactly. That's where the final payoff is, because that's where the energy that has been stored in the form of a proton gradient established by the transfer of electrons finally gets put to work phosphorylating ADP molecules into ATP molecules, and that is where by far most of the ATP molecules that can be made using the energy from glucose are actually made if you go through with the whole process. And in this first slide, we're just looking at a little cartoon of how this happens. We're looking at a mitochondrion, of course. We've been in the mitochondrion for a long time because ever since glycolysis, everything else happens in the mitochondrion, right? Oxidative phosphorylation of pyruvate gets that fuel into the mitochondrion through both membranes, inner and outer, so that we've been in the matrix, really, for several chapters. That citric acid cycle occurs in the matrix. That's where the oxidation of the fuel gets completed. And then transfer of electrons through the chains, of course, doesn't occur in the matrix. It occurs at the inner membrane because the electron transport chains are members of that inner mitochondrial membrane. So you can cheat and look, but you should also already know what the direction of the pumping of the protons is. What is that? Where are the protons pumped from during electron transport? From the matrix, and they're pumped to where? To the intermembrane space. And that's one reason why these two fluid compartments of the mitochondrion differ chemically, simply because of the disequity of or inequity of hydrogen ion concentration or proton concentration or pH. Those all really mean the same thing, right? But there's another reason why the chemical composition of the two compartments differs. Something I've mentioned before. What is that? Correct. The outer mitochondrial membrane is very permeable to a lot of things. And that's why the chemical composition of the fluid in the intermembrane space is pretty much the same as the chemical composition of the cytosol, which is totally outside of the mitochondrion. This outer mitochondrial membrane is there, but really, in terms of how all this stuff operates, you can ignore it. The only thing that really is a permeability barrier to the important things we're talking about is the inner mitochondrial membrane, and that's the membrane through which the protons are pumped, powered by the transfer of electrons in the phase we looked at last time. So you see that happening in this cartoon. The black arrow shows you that protons are being removed from the matrix, pumped through the inner membrane, and land in the intermembrane space, that creates the gradient. Now that gradient, as I keep saying, is a form of energy, form of potential energy. There's two components to this proton gradient, though. There is a chemical component, and there is an electrical component. So you can reasonably enough, or descriptively enough, call this whole gradient an electrochemical gradient. The chemical component of the gradient simply refers to the fact that the concentration of the particle, protons, is different on one side of the membrane compared to the other. Just like you would have a concentration gradient of any particle, charged or uncharged, right? That's just because of the concentration difference, which some books will describe as a pH gradient. Well, that's simply because pH is defined as based on the concentration of hydrogen ions. So it's just a different way of saying the concentration gradient of protons, if you say a proton gradient. But the electrical component comes from the fact that this isn't just a neutral particle that's being pumped and that has a gradient, a concentration gradient. It's a charged particle, an ion. And therefore, when you pump protons and move them from one side of the membrane to the other, from one compartment to the other, you are changing, you're moving electrical charges around, and you're changing the distribution of electrical charges across that membrane. And just like the pumping of sodium and potassium ions by the sodium-potassium exchange pumps and the diffusion of some of those ions back down the gradient establishes a plasma membrane potential in all cells, all living cells. Well, I mean all of your cells. Plants don't use sodium-potassium exchange pumps, but they use proton pumps. In any case, when you're moving an ion around, you are not only causing a chemical gradient, a concentration gradient, you're also creating a charge gradient. And what is the one word name that we give that really means gradient of electrical potential? That's two words. I'm talking about in general, whether we're talking about a biotic system or not. Yes, voltage. That's what voltage is. Voltage is a gradient of electrical potential energy, meaning that there's more of a charge in one place compared to another, like there is between the two slots in a receptacle on the wall. Right? Which is why when you plug something in there, you get it to do some work for you. All right? Well, here you're having, because you're moving positive charges around in the form of these protons, you're establishing a voltage across the thickness of that inner membrane. And since the protons are being exported from the matrix, that's leaving the matrix comparatively negative. Now, I shouldn't say the matrix because it's not the entire matrix. Just like when the sodium-potassium exchange pumps work to create the plasma membrane potential in your cells, it's not that the entire cytosol gets negative. It's neutral because there's roughly as many positives as negatives in the cytosol, just like in the extracellular fluid. But there's a local negativity to just the population of particles that are lined up at the interior of the membrane and those that are lined up just on the exterior of the membrane. So the export of these protons means that the inner surface of that membrane is going to be comparatively negative because you're taking away positives. And the exterior surface, which we can call the cytoplasmic surface, even though it's not technically in direct contact with the cytoplasm, it's the same thing as cytoplasm, though, the inner membrane space. So this exterior surface or cytoplasmic face of the inner membrane is going to be comparatively positive. Okay, that is a voltage. If they were equally charged on either side, the voltage would be zero. In other words, there wouldn't be a gradient of electrical potential. Okay, so both of these components add up to the overall electrochemical gradient that is established by transfer of protons powering the pumping of these. I mean, the transfer of electrons powering the pumping of the protons. That's the situation that has a payoff because of what you already know. We're going to not allow protons to just diffuse freely back into the matrix, which would waste all that energy. Instead, we're going to force those protons that want to diffuse back into the matrix to re-enter the matrix only where we want them to enter so that they'll do some work for us, namely through what? What is it? ATP synthase molecules, which are embedded in this inner membrane along with all the complexes of the electron transport chains. Okay, so the electron transport chains work hand in hand with ATP synthases, but they are not directly attached. They're not, even though they work hand in hand, they can operate independently of each other. The electron transport chains and the ATP synthases can operate independently. And that's demonstrated by an experiment whose results are shown in slide 2. This is an artificial vesicle that's been produced. So you're seeing it in just cross-section. A vesicle, of course, is a complete three-dimensional bag made up of membrane material. But it's artificially produced in this experiment. And the pink slice at the top is a part of the vesicle in which they have embedded bacterial rhodopsin. Now, rhodopsin is a pigment, and it's the same pigment that operates in the light-sensitive cells of your retinas, allowing you to see. But in certain prokaryotes that have bacterial rhodopsin, which is not, bacterial rhodopsin is not what's in our eyes, just the rhodopsin component of bacterial rhodopsin. Anyway, in bacterial rhodopsin, the absorption of photons, which is what pigments do, right? The rhodopsin component of bacterial rhodopsin absorbs photons, and that energy source, the energy that was in the photons, which the photon gets destroyed whenever a photon is absorbed, it gets destroyed. So something has to happen to that energy, right? In bacterial rhodopsin, that energy is harnessed, just like it is in chlorophyll, pretty much, to do some work for that, for those prokaryotic cells that have it. Well, what they use the energy from the sunlight for is to pump protons. So bacterial rhodopsin is a proton pump, a light-powered proton pump. They artificially took these rhodopsin, bacterial rhodopsin molecules out of their natural source and put them into these artificial vesicles. The vesicle also contains in it ATP synthase molecules, one of which is shown on the bottom. So this is not a mitochondrion. This is an artificial vesicle, and these are the only components. There is no electron transport chain in this membrane like there would be in an inner mitochondrial membrane, right? So the rationale behind this experiment is to show that ATP synthase operates even if there isn't an electron transport chain there. They're not intimately related, but they work hand in hand functionally. So by making this vesicle, all they had to do is shine light on the solution that has these artificial vesicles in it. By shining the light, that does the same thing that light does naturally in the archaeans that have this bacterial rhodopsin in them naturally. It's going to pump protons. It pumps them into the lumen of this vesicle, And that's, of course, creating a gradient, exactly like the electron transport chain does, except this one is doing it for without any electron transport chain's help. The point here is that ATP synthase doesn't care whether the proton gradient was created by the electron transport chain or anything else. As long as there's a gradient, protons will go through the ATP synthase molecule, and that's actually what's causing it to turn. So, by turning, the ATP synthase molecule does exactly what it's doing in a mitochondrion, namely, it phosphorylates ADP into ATP. So just by shining light on these artificial vesicles, they are able to detect the creation of ATP molecules. That demonstrates pretty elegantly and pretty well that electron transport chain is not physically hooked to the ATP synthase molecules. But in a natural situation, in a natural mitochondrion, the ATP synthase molecules are not going to spin unless there is a proton gradient. And that proton gradient is not going to be created unless you have electron transport. That's why they do work hand in hand, even though they're not physically connected. All right, let's take a closer look at an ATP synthase molecule in slide 3. Technically speaking, it's more than one molecule because it's a complex. It's a protein that has many subunits in it. And each subunit technically is its own. Each polypeptide is a molecule. But anyway, we usually say ATP synthase molecule to just mean one of these complexes. And notice that it's partially embedded in the plasma inner mitochondrial membrane. Part of it sticks out though, and we therefore can define the overall complex as having two parts to it, the F0 unit and the F1 unit, as you see. And as the brackets indicate, really the only thing that matters with that classification is whether it's embedded in the membrane or not, that part. The F0 is simply the part that actually is embedded in the membrane. The F1 unit is not. And where is the F1 hanging? I mean, in what compartment? In what? In the matrix, correct. So this is the matrix side of the membrane, the bottom of this figure. All right, well, notice also you have a bunch of letters denoting the individual polypeptide subunits of this ATP synthase molecule. And you have letters that you're familiar with, and you also have Greek letters. The difference between which alphabet they use determines also whether this thing is actually touching the lipid interior of the membrane. Okay, so you use A, B, and C to denote the three different kinds of polypeptides that are actually integral to the membrane itself in direct contact with those phospholipids. Now, B2 means that there are two polypeptides making that up. The C ring is multiple copies of the C polypeptide. And I'll talk more about what the number is because the number depends on the species, actually. But there is some number of copies of C polypeptides making up this overall C ring, the blue one. And then A is in intimate contact with that C ring, and the A component, the A subunit, is where protons are going to actually make it through the membrane, which I'll describe more in a minute. Now, all these ones below those on this figure, all the ones that are in the actual matrix rather than being integral to the protein, to the membrane itself, use Greek letters. So alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon. So that's just the only reason that they used Greek letters for those instead, because these ones are hanging into the matrix. Well, there is what is called the alpha 3, beta 3 knob which is the all the yellows and all the oranges collectively as forming this one knob-like structure. That is a heterohexamer. Why is it a heterohexamer? I mean, you should be able to tell me that just from the word. There are six, it's a hexamer because there are six polypeptides making it up. But why is it more specifically a heterohexamer? Yeah, they're not six identical copies. There are three alphas that are identical to each other and three betas. So there are two different kinds of subunits here for a total of six, though. So all the oranges, all the alphas are identical, and that's why we just say alpha sub 3, and all the betas are the same, so beta sub 3. The overall knob is alpha 2, beta 2. That surrounds, as you see in pink, a gamma subunit, which is in contact with the epsilon. The epsilon is there for structural integrity, but the gamma subunit, the pink one, is really going to be important for the operation of this alpha 2, beta 2 knob, which is also called the catalytic knob by some books. So obviously it's the part that has catalytic activity, the knob itself. But that's going to require a special interaction between the gamma subunit and the knob itself. Well, the gamma subunit is connected to the C ring that's in the membrane. And the C ring can spin like a carousel. Since it's connected to the gamma and the epsilon, actually, that means when the C ring spins within the membrane, the gamma is also going to spin out in the matrix along with it because they're connected. Now the B2 subunit, which is anchored to the A subunit up in the membrane but hanging down into the matrix as well, that B2 subunit, which is connected to the delta subunit down in the matrix as you see here, holds the knob in place. And so we have really just a little motor here. There are two fundamental parts of an electric motor, right? What are those two functional parts? Anyone know about motors? Well, I don't mean... Yeah, that's true. But I mean, what you have in a given motor is a part that moves and a part that does not move. The part that moves is called the rotor. It spins, it rotates. And the part that stays put is the stator. Static means unmoving, right? So the stator in the ATP synthase molecule is formed by the combination of A, B2, delta, plus the knob itself. Those all stay put. They don't spin. Everything else together, the C ring and the gamma and epsilon components, constitute the rotor. And that's important because, like I said, the catalytic activity of the catalytic knob, the alpha 2 beta 2, the alpha 3 beta 3, is not going to work unless gamma rotates with respect to the knob itself. The rotor has to spin it with respect to the stator for this thing to operate. Also, by the way, a motor can be used as a motor, which case you're supplying the energy in order to make it move. But you can run that apparatus in reverse as well, right? You can force it to spin and you'll create energy as a process. In that case, it's used as a generator. A motor run in reverse is a generator. You produce electricity out of forcing it to move, however you force it to move, by hand cranking it or whatever. Or you can supply the energy in the form of electricity, and it will move because of that. Similarly, this ATP synthase molecule is reversible. The way that we're going to talk about it in terms of oxidation of glucose to make ATP is to run in the direction of producing ATP, which you need to supply energy for, which is in the form of the dissipation of the proton gradient, right? That's the form of energy. But if this is run in reverse, what you could do is supply it with ATP, and the protons will go in the opposite direction. And you, by spending the energy of that ATP, you can create a proton gradient. And this is how some cells use the same exact molecule, in reverse. But we're using it in the direction, for cellular respiration, we're using it in the direction of supplying the proton gradient in order to make it spin in the direction that will phosphorylate ADP and make ATP for us. Anyway, that's the overall structure. Let's take a closer look at the catalytic knob now in slide 4. I told you already that the three alphas are identical to each other, as are the three betas. The alphas, even though they're part of what we call the catalytic knob, they're really just structural components. They don't have catalytic activity with respect to producing ATP. They hold the thing together. They hold the betas in the correct position. The betas are what have the catalytic activity. And the key to understanding how this actually operates is to realize that even though the betas are all identical to each other, each individual beta at any given moment can be in any of three different configurations or conformations or shapes. We abbreviate those as O, L, and T, as you see in black letters around the periphery. O stands for the open conformation, L for the loose conformation, and T for the tight conformation. These words describe the tightness of fit between the beta subunit itself, which is an enzyme, the active site of that enzyme, and the substrates. All right? So in the open conformation, which in this cartoon is green, and importantly, it's not that this beta one is always in the open conformation. And all three betas can be open, loose, or tight. But there's, within the overall catalytic knob, only one of the betas is going to be open at any given moment. One will be in loose and one will be in tight. But this one that's labeled as O is in the open conformation right now. And if a beta subunit is in the open conformation, then that means it doesn't really hang on to the product that it just produced, which is why in the open conformation you're going to have product released. And our product is ATP, right? So in the open conformation, ATP that's just been created pops off of this beta subunit. But that then allows for two new substrates to come in. The two substrates are ADP and inorganic phosphate. And that's why you see that green section labeled as ADP plus orthophosphate or inorganic phosphate, P sub I. Okay. In the loose conformation, the blue one in this cartoon, there is a better fit between substrate and enzyme than there is in the open, but not as good as it's going to get. In the loose conformation, it partially hugs the substrates and keeps them from leaving. So in other words, it captures them. But it doesn't, the conformation change isn't enough to actually force the ADP and the inorganic phosphate together. just keeps it from falling off, basically. Then in the tight conformation, the yellow one, that's a full-on hug between the enzyme and the substrates. And it brings the ADP and the inorganic phosphate together so intimately that it actually phosphorylates the ADP and forms ATP. Okay? Now, the reaction shown here in the yellow section is shown as reversible because of what I just told you. This thing can operate at the expense of ATP to create a proton gradient, but we're studying it in the reverse direction, which is the direction it operates for cellular respiration, which is we're phosphorylating ADP into ATP by using the proton gradient. Okay, but anyway, that in the tight conformation, that's when the phosphorylation actually takes place, this oxidative phosphorylation for which this overall final two-part process in cellular respiration is named. This is distinct from substrate-level phosphorylation, which is what occurred to make all of the ATP elsewhere and previously in the process, in glycolysis and in the citric acid cycle. That was substrate level phosphorylation. Some substrate was carrying a phosphate and it transfers it over to ADP to make ATP. That's substrate level phosphorylation. Here, we're hooking an inorganic phosphate directly onto an ADP based on the power of redox reactions, which is why it's called oxidative phosphorylation. Okay? Now, what is it that determines whether any given beta subunit is in the O, L, or T configuration? Well, you can see kind of from the cartoon, but does anyone know anyway? Anyone else? I mean, exactly. It depends on what the position of the gamma rod, and we're looking at this thing from the bottom of the knob, if with respect to slide 3. We're looking at it from within the matrix up at the bottom of this knob. The gamma is at the core of that knob, but very importantly, the gamma rod, which is part of the rotor, is not symmetrical on its surface. It's not like a smooth cylinder, for instance, which means depending on how far it's turned, its shape will be different in that position. And therefore, its interaction, the interaction between that gamma and the beta, is going to be different for each of the three betas. That's illustrated by this little cam-like part that's hanging off of the surface of the gamma, and the invagination here, and then just the smooth surface here. It's different on all three sides of the actual rotor, which is the gamma subunit. So if this thing spins with respect to the knob, which is staying place, that means you're going to change a beta shape because of that interaction between beta and gamma from open to loose and then to tight and then back to open and then over and over. It's that order, though. Open, loose, tight. Open, loose, tight. All right? Now, for that to happen, this gamma rod would have to be rotating counterclockwise as we're looking up from the bottom. And I think the book says we're looking at it from the top. That's wrong. We're looking at it from the bottom. If it spins the other way, which it can, then it's going to go, that's going to be operating in reverse. Okay, that's the way it would have to spin in order to spend ATP, break it into ADP and inorganic phosphate in order to power the pumping of protons. Here we're looking at it the opposite way. Okay? So in slide 5, we can see this counterclockwise movement of the gamma rotor with respect to the catalytic knob. And when that happens, what was originally the O configuration beta is going to become an L configuration beta. So the colors stay the same here to denote that is the same beta subunit, but the letters change because that beta subunit is going to go from the open conformation to the loose and then to the tight. Okay, as the gamma spins. So the reason the colors are staying the same here is to indicate that this knob is not moving, right? The knob is the stator. It's staying the same. But this beta subunit that is green is going to change shape from O to L because the gamma has rotated 120 degrees. So now it's in contact with the part of the gamma that was in contact with the blue one, right? Because it's moving counterclockwise. That's going to make the green one in the same shape that the blue one was. And it's going to make the blue one in the shape that the T one was. That's what happens. That's why you have to have this asymmetry on the surface of the stator, the gamma rod. Otherwise, it wouldn't force these three conformational changes, or the changes between these beta subunits into the three conformations, which is necessary for the whole phosphorylation to occur. Okay? Everyone good on that? Now, when, like I said before, once you're into the tight conformation, that's when the catalysis occurs. That's when phosphorylation actually takes place, and you have an ATP molecule that you didn't have before. It's still temporarily connected to the enzyme, just like product is in any enzymatic reaction, but then it gets released, right? Well, it gets released when that tight conformation enzyme, which made the ATP molecule and still is hanging on to it, when it gets transformed back into the open conformation by another one-third of a revolution of the gamma rod or rotor. That's when it's going to be able to release it, and that's when two new substrates come in, an ADP molecule and an orthophosphate. And it just keeps repeating. So since there are three beta subunits, that means every rotation of the rotor with respect to the stator produces three ATP molecules, right? Three ATPs are produced per revolution of the rotor, of the gamma rod. But that's only going to occur if something is forcing that thing to spin, right? And the something that is forcing it to spin is the diffusion of hydrogen ions down their gradient from where they've been pumped to, which is the intermembrane space, through the ATP synthase molecule F0 unit, which is the part that's embedded in the membrane, and specifically through that A subunit into the compartment from which they've been pumped, which is back into the matrix. That's what continues this thing spinning and therefore continues the phosphorylation of ADP. All right, let's take a closer look then in slide 6 at that A subunit. This purple A subunit acts as a channel, which is nothing new. You've looked at several examples of proteins in other classes that act as channels, right? They're embedded in the membrane and they allow for a specific type of thing to pass through the hollow part of that channel. This one's a little bit different though because there are two half channels in it. Each half channel is a dead end. Open on one end, but then at the dead end, you're just in the middle of this protein and can't get any farther. Well, the cytoplasmic half channel has its open end continuous with the intermembrane space, which is the cytoplasmic side of the intermembrane. The matrix half channel, its open end is facing the matrix. But the two half channels are staggered with respect to each other. All right? Well, think about how the gradient is. The gradient is such, because of the electron transport, that protons are in greater concentration in the intermembrane space. So they want, in this picture, to diffuse downward. You don't see the membrane here, but the membrane includes this A subunit. So protons want to be coming in from the top and go down to the bottom. They're able to get into this cytoplasmic half channel, but they're not able to get all the way through to the matrix because of this dead end. So in order for them to actually get all the way into the matrix, they need to leave this dead end and get hooked on to one of the several C subunits that form that ring that this A, purple A subunit is right against. And the business end of a C ring subunit, one of which you see right here, this is one of those rods in the blue ring of the original picture. The business end of it, though, is an aspartic acid residue. Aspartic acid is just one of the 20 biological amino acids. So it's the only one we care about. The rest of it is just shown as a helix, because this aspartic acid residue is able to pick up a proton. Now, it's called aspartic acid because it's one of the two amino acids that have, as part of the R group, a carboxyl group, which makes it a carboxylic acid, right? It's a carboxylic acid. I mean, a carboxylic acid is an acid like any other acid which can donate a proton. At physiological pH, though, it's in the deprotonated form, right? Which is why we don't really usually call it aspartic acid. We call it aspartate, which is the deprotonated form. Well, that's a reversible reaction, though. If an aspartic acid has lost its proton to become aspartate, it can receive a proton back. All right? That's exactly what happens to the proton that makes it to this dead end in the cytoplasmic half channel. That's going to juxtapose it, or put it right next to one of these subunit C's. And that proton is therefore going to latch on to this aspartate residue, neutralizing it, basically, right? In its deprotonated form, the aspartate is charged. It's negatively charged. But when the proton gets added to it, that neutralizes the charge. The reason that's important is because this aspartic acid doesn't want to be around, or the aspartate, I should say, the deprotonated form, does not want to be around the hydrophobic tails of the phospholipids making up the membrane that this whole thing is embedded in. Right? But once you put a proton onto it, you neutralize it, and therefore it has no problem being around those hydrophobic tails. That's the key to what makes this thing actually spin. Let's look at the next slide to describe it even better. Slide 7. Now we have the complete C ring in place, with the A subunit in its two half channels that at the moment are empty. Okay, on this upper left, they're empty. The negatives that are put in there are not actually part of the A subunit, the purple subunit. Those negatives are the aspartate residues that are part of the C rings. Those two individual C subunits have in that position the deprotonated form, the aspartate form, whereas all the other ones have a hydrogen ion on them, so they are neutral and therefore don't mind being around the tails of these phospholipids, like I said. Okay? Now, assuming the proton gradient is already in place, which it will be if the electron transport chain has been operating, then a proton wants to diffuse downward in this picture, meaning from the intermembrane space to the matrix. So you see a proton coming into this half channel from above. That's going to put it into the position where it can, as a positive ion, latch right onto that negatively charged aspartate of the C subunit that it's next to. All right? Now just, well, before that happens, when we have both of them negative, both C subunits, each of which is associated with a half channel, if they are in the negative configuration, then this C ring isn't going to be able to rotate either direction. Because rotating in either direction is going to put a negatively charged aspartate right up against a hydrophobic tail of a phospholipid. You see what I'm saying there? Everyone following on that? That's what, without any proton coming in at first, this thing would just be locked in place. The C ring wouldn't move in either direction. Okay, now the proton comes in from above into the cytoplasmic half channel. That neutralizes this aspartate into aspartic acid, the protonated form. So now it's neutral, and therefore this thing could stay where it is, but it could also rotate from above. It would be a clockwise rotation. It's going to rotate in the direction that arrow indicates, which is this way, right? Just one subunit worth of rotation is all it would be able to do. Because if you rotated it two, then you would get this negative in contact with the phospholipid tail again. All right? And this, if it does rotate one notch, then that's going to bring this hydrogen ion that's at the other end of the carousel, basically. It's going to put it into the position of being at this blind end of the other half channel, the matrix half channel. And when that happens, then the hydrogen can dissociate from the aspartic acid and just diffuse down its gradient into the matrix through the open end. All right, that's going to leave this one negative again. So that's going to, the fact that it's negative is going to prevent it from rotating the opposite direction. And when another proton comes in, it's going to allow it to rotate, continue rotating in the same direction that we were describing. All right, everyone clear on that? And this just is a cycle. Yeah, every proton you add, it's going to rotate it one more notch. And by notch, I mean one more C subunits worth of rotation. And this is why it matters to an organism how many C subunits make up that ring. Because however many C subunits there are, it's going to take that many protons diffusing to rotate it once, right? Well, the fewer C subunits you have, the fewer protons you need to make one whole rotation, and therefore the more efficient this thing is going to be. Because every time you diffuse a proton down its gradient into the matrix, you're spending some of that gradient, some of that stored energy in the form of gradient. So if you have fewer numbers of C's subunits, you're not going to spend as much of that gradient to do the same job of spinning this thing once. And spinning it once is going to mean what in terms of ATP? What is it? You're going to make three ATPs for each spin. So an organism that has a higher number of C subunits is still going to make three ATP per rotation, but it's going to spend more proton gradient to do that. And therefore, it's going to spend more energy that was originally in the glucose to do that. And therefore, the final payoff in terms of ATP per glucose will be lower in those organisms. The smallest number of C subunits in a C ring that we've discovered is in vertebrates, which, of course, we're members of. So we have very efficient ATP synthase molecules, And this makes sense based on our lifestyle, especially mammals among the vertebrates, because mammals and birds, because we really spend a lot of energy being endotherms. We just, when we're at rest, we idle very high. That takes a lot of energy to do that. So we need an efficient mechanism. Now, it would be beneficial to all the other organisms too, of course, but it just hasn't evolved that way yet. Well, in slide 8, we can see now in just one spin of this whole C-ring, there's only one proton shown here, but that's because the one proton that comes in originally has to take one trip all the way around the carousel, the C-ring, before it gets delivered to that other half channel so that it can then finally diffuse into the matrix. But the reason that it's able to go around one trip is because you continue to have one proton coming in from above, allowing it to rotate one notch as it goes. All right? That is what is analogous to pouring water over the water wheel. That's what does the work for you. Because it's the gradient, the tendency for protons to diffuse in this direction, that causes this spinning, and the fact that this C-ring is solidly connected to the gamma rotor, that gamma rotor also spins every time the C-ring spins. And therefore the beta subunits go from open to loose to tight, and therefore ADP gets phosphorylated. Yes, the B2, let's look at the picture again. The B2 subunit hangs down from the A subunit into the matrix, and by connection to the delta, forms a connection to the overall catalytic knob. That's what holds this catalytic knob in place and doesn't allow it to spin. That's why it's the stator. The knob itself is part of the stator. Everything that doesn't move, doesn't rotate, is the stator. The gamma, though, is the most important part of the rotor, because that's what actually causes the conformational changes in the beta subunits. Okay, well, that's really the end of the process, because it's just a matter of spending that gradient, spending the energy in that gradient to spin the catalytic knob, to spin the rotor with respect to the catalytic knob, in order to make a lot more ATP than you would just by stopping at glycolysis. What, though, you have to keep in mind is that you wouldn't have this gradient if it weren't for electrons being continuously delivered to the chains, and you wouldn't have electrons being continually delivered to the chains if you didn't have carriers of those electrons that first stripped those electrons from the fuel somewhere, right? What I'm talking about are the coenzymes. NADH and FADH2 are continuously supplying the electron transport chains with those electrons, because as soon as the electron transfer stops, the pumping of protons stops, and the gradient that's in place will still work to spin some ATP synthase molecules, but when it comes to zero, when there is no more gradient, there's no tendency for protons to go in one net direction into the matrix, and therefore that rotor will just stop spinning and no more ATP will be made. Well, the electron transport chain is represented by the four yellow complexes down here that we've already talked about in. Notice that complex 2 is not doing any pumping, which we've already talked about, right? What is complex 2 all about? From what? Yes, exactly. Complex 2 is the one that's associated with FAD, not NAD. And FADH2, which gets its electrons from succinate, immediately delivers them to what? Coenzyme Q, exactly. Transforming it into ubiquinol, right? transforming ubiquinone into ubiquinol. So that bypasses this first pump. And once again, that's why FADH2 isn't as valuable in terms of storing energy as NADH is. But the pumping is such that the protons get delivered into the intermembrane space. This is one crystal we're looking at, by the way. That's why it's matrix on the top and the bottom. Right? This is just, the intermembrane space is in the middle here just because this is one fold. So the catalytic knob, as you said before correctly, is situated in the matrix, and that means that's where the ATP gets produced, in the matrix. Okay? The intermembrane space, though, is where the protons get pumped to, and then they trickle by diffusion through the ATP synthase molecules back into the matrix. Oh, and we can't discount the importance of oxygen to this, right? Oxygen serves as the final electron acceptor from complex 4. And if oxygen is no longer available, then everything comes to a halt, right? As far as cellular respiration is concerned. The electron transport chain will fill up with electrons. Therefore, there will be no more pumping of protons, no more production of ATP via oxidative phosphorylation. When you back up the electron transport chain, fill it up with electrons, that means you no longer have NADH dropping off their electrons, right? They stay in the reduced form. And what's going to happen out in the cytosol in that case? Fermentation is going to be the alternative, exactly right. Under anaerobic conditions, the only way to continue glycolysis, which requires a continuous supply of NAD+, is to do something with those electrons on NADH that's produced out in the cytosol. And in us, what do we do with those electrons? We stick them onto what? NADH dumps them onto what? In us, when there's no oxygen available. Pyruvate, right. We dump them onto pyruvate and turn it into lactate, right? That's why we're lactate or lactic acid fermenters. That will allow glycolysis to continue, which will still net you 2 ATPs per glucose, but that's nowhere near the 30-plus ATPs that are made by cellular respiration per glucose. By the way, another thing that's in this figure is the term proton motive force, which I think is what the chapter title is. Proton motive force refers to the gradient of protons and the fact that that gradient, if allowed to dissipate, does some work for you. It's motive because it moves the actual rotor in the ATP synthase. Right? It's a proton gradient that forms, that meaning that has the effect of moving or motivating the actual ATP synthase molecule. Okay, now to 10. We were just talking about fermentation. And that involves NADHs that are out in the cytoplasm, in the cytosol. Well, the better alternative to fermentation, of course, is cellular respiration, because it'll make you more ATP. But I've kind of been, well, I haven't been kind of, I've been saying all along, I've been kind of lying to you, by saying that the NADHs that are produced in glycolysis dump their electrons, just like the NADHs produced elsewhere, onto the electron transport chain. They actually don't do that directly. And that's because of the relative impermeability of the intermembrane that we keep talking about. NAD doesn't get through the membrane either. Well, there's no problem for the NADH that's produced inside the mitochondrion, which includes the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate and the citric acid cycle. Plus the FADH2, of course, is in the mitochondrion already as well. Those can dump their electrons directly onto the chain members, either complex 1 or complex 2. But the NADH that's produced by glycolysis is out in the cytosol, and it can't get through the inner mitochondrial membrane. So you have really two fleets of taxis that don't come into contact with each other, a fleet that's inside the mitochondrion and a fleet that's out in the cytosol. The electrons being carried by that cytosolic fleet of NAD still get delivered to the electron transport chain, just not directly from that taxi. It requires a shuttle of some sort. And we're looking at an example of a shuttle here in slide 10. This one is called the glycerol 3-phosphate shuttle. And notice the two black substances, one on either side of the slide here. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate and glycerol 3-phosphate. Now, it might seem like we've talked about both of these things before, but really only one of these have we talked about before in another process. Which one? Right. Oh, no. Sorry. The one on the left. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Where did that come into play? What else? It's also involved in glycolysis, right? It's one of the two isomers that are produced when aldolase does its job, right? But it's not the one that's allowed to go on to the rest of glycolysis. So it has to be transformed into the other one. Well, the other one in glycolysis is not glycerol 3-phosphate. It's similar. What is it instead? Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate. Exactly. The difference is that this top carbon has a carbonyl on it rather than a hydroxyl as it is here. So this is just a glycerol molecule with a phosphate on it, on the third carbon. So it's glycerol 3-phosphate. And the shuttle, whose job it is to deliver electrons from cytosolic NADH into the mitochondrial matrix, involves the interconversion between glycerol 3-phosphate and dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Now, naturally enough, this is going to involve some enzymes as well. Two copies of two different enzymes are going to be involved here. And so in the blue text, you can see the names of one type of enzyme. Well, it's actually two different enzymes because they're isozymes, but it's one type of enzyme. That's glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, as you see. All right? We haven't talked about that enzyme before because this isn't the same thing as in glycolysis, right? Glycerol 3-phosphate is different from glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, so these aren't just being isomerized like they are in glycolysis. Instead, to get from dihydroxyacetone phosphate to glycerol, you need to stick hydrogens onto that dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Okay? Well, this is good in terms of our goal, because hydrogens are what are carrying the electrons that got stripped from the fuel and need to be delivered to the electron transport chain, right? So the first part of the operation of this shuttle is out in the cytosol, where that NADH that was produced by glycolysis is, the NADH at the top. It's going to get rid of the hydrogen that it collected from the fuel and stick it on to dihydroxyacetone phosphate. Those pink H's are going to transform dihydroxyacetone phosphate into glycerol 3-phosphate. You can see they are now part of this. Okay? Now, those hydrogens and therefore the electrons are still outside of the mitochondrion at this point. Well, technically, they're not, because this is happening inside the intermembrane space. But they're outside of the matrix. Okay, they're not yet through the membrane that counts, which is this membrane, the inner membrane. And so on the cytoplasmic surface, or the intermembrane space surface, the outer surface of the inner membrane, is an isozyme of glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase that we find in the cytoplasm. Okay? And descriptively enough, it's called mitochondrial rather than cytoplasmic glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase. This form of the same enzyme, I mean, they're the same enzyme because they do the same job, but they do them in opposite directions. And by naming this thing glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase, we're really describing the direction in which it operates for the mitochondrial version, indicated by the yellow ellipse. Because to dehydrogenate glycerol 3-phosphate means you're going to turn it back into dihydroxyacetone phosphate. So the cytoplasmic version of the isozyme is named in reverse compared to how it operates, okay? But they are exactly the reverse reaction from each other, just done by two different versions of the enzyme. The reason that's important is because the mitochondrial version of glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase has connected to it as a prosthetic group, an FAD, just like succinate dehydrogenase does, which is part of the citric acid cycle and also part of the electron transport chain like we've talked about. The FAD is permanently attached to this yellow mitochondrial glycerol 3-phosphate dehydrogenase enzyme, in other words. And that's important because when the hydrogens get stripped from glycerol 3-phosphate by the enzyme, those hydrogens get hooked on to this FAD prosthetic group, reducing the FAD into FADH2. And just like what happens in complex 2, which is succinate dehydrogenase, those hydrogens from FADH2 immediately get delivered to coenzyme Q, which is in this same membrane where all the electron transport chains are, right? So Q becomes reduced by FADH2 into QH2. In other words, ubiquinone becomes ubiquinol, transforming FADH2 back into FAD. So that the enzyme is reset, can go another round. Well, notice that what's accomplished here is that the electrons from NADH out in the cytoplasm that came from glucose in glycolysis are delivered to the electron transport chain where they need to be, but indirectly. There's this middleman in the form of these two intermediates, dihydroxyacetone phosphate and glycerol 3-phosphate, and the enzymes involved. Okay. Still the same thing, though. Importantly, though, or interestingly, at least I find it interesting, is that because FAD is a middleman in this whole process, that means the NADH that is chemically identical to the NADH in the citric acid cycle, but the NADH that's produced out in the cytosol actually isn't as valuable if this shuttle is used as the NADH that's produced in the citric acid cycle. Now, it's not the only way that NADH can transfer its electrons into the interior, but it's one way, and it's the predominant way in your skeletal muscles, for instance. And the reason it's not quite as valuable is because by involving FAD, that means you can only dump it onto Q, coenzyme Q. You bypass that first complex, just like you do for succinate dehydrogenase in the citric acid cycle, and therefore you don't pump as many protons, and therefore you don't have as big a payoff in terms of oxidative phosphorylation.
When you're in glycolysis and you form dihydroxyacetone phosphate,
yeah,
does that always occur with that before it gets turned into glyceraldehyde?
No, most of it gets turned into glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate, but there's always some available because of that process, and so some of it is always available. Notice that this isn't consumed, really. You just need a low level of it so that you can make glycerol 3-phosphate, and then you get right back to where you started with. It doesn't take a new one coming in. So it's kind of like an adenine nucleotide going back and forth between ATP and ADP form. You don't have to make new ones. It's just two different configurations. Slide 11 is just in words, a summary of this whole shuttle that we've already looked at. So that's there for you to use as a study aid if necessary, but there's no new information there. That brings us to 12. Here we have another shuttle. Remember I said that that's not the only way that NAD can get its electrons into the matrix. This is another way. This shuttle is called the malate aspartate shuttle, named for two of the players in this game. So this is the inner mitochondrial membrane, as you'd expect. The matrix side is on the bottom. The intermembrane space, or the cytoplasmic side, is on the top. The two orange membrane-bound proteins are transport proteins, of course, but they are specifically co-transport proteins, or co-transporters. I'm sorry, co-transporters. Co-transporters are not only transport proteins, but they are dual transporters, meaning that two different types of particles get transported at the same time by that one protein. Now, there are two subclasses of co-transporters, depending on the two possibilities. The two possibilities are that the two different kinds of particles get moved in the same direction at the same time, in which case that thing is called a symport. Sym, S-Y-M, means together. The other possibility is that the two different kinds of particles get moved in opposite directions with respect to each other at the same time. In which case that thing is called, it's still a co-transporter, but it's more specifically called an antiport. Antiport, A-N-T-I-P-O-R-T. And that's exactly what we have here. We have two different antiports here, because each one of them is moving two different things in two different directions. So, the one on the left is a malate alpha-ketoglutarate antiport, because it moves those two different things in opposite directions. And specifically, it's moving malate into the matrix in exchange for alpha-ketoglutarate, which is coming out of the matrix and being put into the intermembrane space. The other antiporter, which has to work at the same time for the overall shuttle to operate, is taking care of two totally different particles. This one is an aspartate glutamate antiport, and specifically it's moving aspartate into the intermembrane space, taking it out of the matrix, in other words. Just the opposite for glutamate. It's putting glutamate into the matrix in exchange for that aspartate. And so I'll have to describe the rest of the operation next time.